In my first lecture, I attempted on purpose to paint a rather broad canvas talking about, as a theme, what do saints embody? And I think it's important for not assuming that mutatis mutandis, you say saints, we say something else. It's more or less the same. And perforce, I think the central issue to me is not so much the sociology, although that's pretty interesting, and of course the exegesis, but why are they considered saintly? Now that's somewhat of a circle here, but I wanted to talk about what it means to be enlightened, which I use as simply a transfer term for now you get the words in this lecture. So I wanted to say something, first of all, because the historical, diachronic, objective historicist gauntlet has been thrown down by my colleague Barry, to say something about the reach and range of what we might even call sacred text within the Buddhist traditions. We saw the periodization that Barry gave us for a way of getting a handle, although in a very sketchy way, of the traditions that are called Jewish. And our colleague Aziz also did something similarly, so I thought just to give you a sense of what are the terms which are used in reference within the tradition itself. And what I want to make clear is that all of the tensions about insider view, a privileged kind of exegetical interpretation by one or a group of sects at a certain period of time or over history versus the new modern secular higher scholarship and how that makes the case or intentionally or unintentionally denigrates certain faith commitments, all of those issues exist, as far as I can tell, in all the traditions that are called religious, and it's something we get gray, in my case white hair about when we go to religious studies meetings. So there's nothing new whatsoever in the controversies between insider views, and I use the technical anthropological term emic, E-M-I-C, insider's views, and there's not one view, and outsider views, which can mean many things. One who does not have a faith commitment, that's one of the understandings, and that latter term for outsider view, edic, E-T-I-C, can mean two things. One who does not have a faith commitment to the tradition they're studying, nor are they doing in their studies an attempt to find what those who do have a faith commitment say, but rather something else. And that something else might be called objective, what really happened, as opposed to the faithful. And of course, both positions solve nothing, but rather raise other issues. So we ain't going to save that. We're not going to resolve any of that. I just wanted to show that those tensions there have been explicitly used in most graduate courses in the world in teaching religious studies. So we don't have to unconsciously recapitulate that here. If we consciously think about conflict of interpretations and what are the faith implications behind all of this, or as Alon was trying to say, you know, what does this have to do with maybe the impetus for why we even want to have a conference on saints, who cares, we might have said, you know, or saints, I care. It's in the background there. That's the background. What I wanted to first say on the left side of the board, first of all, is what is considered sacred text or canonical in the Buddhist traditions, and I've listed four different things. First of all, starting with A, and this is all emic categories. This is not external historical, but it does bear some resemblance, fortunately, to what scholars say. There are the words attributed to the Buddha in terms of talks or sermons. I put in square or rectangular boxes all the technical terms, so you just don't have to flail on my Englishing. You can find this if you're so motivated in Sanskrit. Sources. So, sutra, talks are the sermons of the Buddha. Just to remind ourselves, and you know, if Barry got accused of doing short shrift to the Abrahamic tradition, that is to say, the tradition of Abraham, this is, fortunately, I think I'm the only, you know, Buddhist, and you know, it's not stacked against me here. So I can give a really, really truncated version of the life of the Buddha. Again, for those of you who weren't here, born, there were some indications that he was going to be a great leader either in the worldly or the transworldly realm. His father said, I want you to go into the company business, to use Alon's analogy, and so tried to shield from him certain existential truths about mortality, about pain, about suffering. And he saw a serene man who seemed to know that all living beings would die, and it is in the nature of being human that when they're crowded and unhappy, they hurt each other. And he asked himself the question, how is life worth living given that this is true, that I'm going to die, and human beings, when they're not happy, hurt each other. This was his motivation at the age of 29 to drop out of the company business, which in this case would have been to be a royal person. And then he went searching for 6 years, and in that 6 years, he studied with the best and the brightest sages of the time. At the age of 29, he dropped out. Age of 35, so the hagiographic handing down tells us. As to the historicity, who knows? Parenthetically, some of you who are Christian scholars, that is to say, scholars of Christianity, know there's this vexed problem of the synoptic gospels, about 30-year gap. So what are the actual words of Jesus? And it's an interesting enterprise. Double, triple, quadruple that. There's about 150 years between the death of the Buddha and people showing up with what he said. So for those of you who want to go down the merry rows of historicity and the literalness, good luck, you know. At the age of 35, it's said that he sat down and said, I want to come to a full and complete understanding. I've studied with teachers, as was the occasion. In the sacred traditions, you didn't just figure it out for yourself. You went to the best and brightest and then made it your own. And at that point, he went through a series of experiences, which are well recorded, that consisted of his awakening, enlightening, enlightenment at the age of 35. Hence, he got the epithet, the one who has awakened, Buddha. That wasn't his name. That names the state of thorough spiritual transformation. That's the age of 35. For the next 40 plus years, he did his ministry, to use a Christian term. He went all over. So what we call the words of the Buddha in this version are what was collected in the memory of the pious who heard him, each in their own language, in their own way. So that's his background. In terms of what they heard two kinds of things, talks and sermons called sutras that begin, thus at one time did I hear. It's always in the voice of a disciple, and sometimes we know who the disciple is. Later we have sutras that seem to speak directly, unmediatedly. So what's interesting here is canonically there's a bit of a distance, as if the holiness is over there. They are remembering piously what the words were that were said. And we have the names of the specialists who remembered what the Buddha said. Parenthetically, this was all oral. It was all oral. And India, you may or may not know, is renowned for incredible mnemonic devices, palindromes, acrostics, all kinds of ways of remembering sacred text that was handed down. And they would chant it in a certain way to remember. At a certain time, it was felt that spirituality was not as strong as it used to be. Memory wasn't as strong as it used to be, so they'd have to write it down. But in the beginning, all of this was oral, and it was recited upon special occasions like the full moon, etc. So this was all oral. What did they write down? I'm sorry, what did they remember? The sutras, the sermons, the edifying sermons. I put sermons in quotes because, again, that's a Christian term. And the other kind of collection is advice on conduct, advice for those who had maybe a vow of celibacy or those who were householders, etc., the Vinaya. These were the two earliest collections of remembrance of the words of the Buddha. Why do I spend time on this? Because this is a locus textually of what then would be paradigmatic for holiness. So this is important. Yeah, no, the whole schmear. All of it. Oh, yeah. This is all sacred. This whole thing is all sacredness. The whole left thing is sacredness and is normative for these traditions. So then number three, deeper points of the talks in the sermon. The talks and sermons, the sutra, are characteristically in a narrative style. This happened, then that happened, then that happened. And there's a moral in there. those who were studying this long after the death of the Buddha go, well, like, what was the main point? You know, like your little notes, extract. And so there were appendices that we find in the end of the sutras called matrikas, sort of measures. And people collected these. And this is where they said, oh, the Buddha said there's 5 of these and 3 of these and 10 of them are good and 15 are bad. And this is getting to the deeper point, like you're taking the essence and getting rid of the dross. And this was called the deeper points, the Abhidharma. So we had 3. These 3 were gathered by various believing communities. Note the plurality here. Into collections, remembered, and they were sacred to them, and they collected them into what then became the term baskets. There wasn't one sutra, there were collections, each according to the community all over India that they had. And these baskets then, number C, were said to be finally the 3 baskets, the Tripitaka, the baskets of the sutra, the Vinaya, the Abhidharma. This is the ur-texts, if you will, the locus for what is deemed sacred by all Buddhist communities. Footnote, almost all. And so one of the ways, if you say, what's Buddha's word for Bible? Forget Hebrew or Christian, what's just Bible or Quran? What's the holy thing? They would say, or the holy scriptures, or the holy words of the Buddha, they say Tripitaka. It's the 3 collections. Okay? We have them, you see a little arrow off of C there, in 3 canonical languages, each collected by different communities. We have one in a vernacular that's related to Sanskrit called Pali. Okay? You see up there, thank you, Alon. So the Pali texts are the collections of all of this stuff as remembered and recorded, first verbally, orally, and then written down. And these are the canonical texts that are studied by those believing Buddhists who live in such countries as Burma, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and like that. Then there was, in time, a collection from Sanskrit, which was related to Pali. And again, there wasn't one set. This was all over northern India, etc. Remember, the ministry of Jesus was 3 years, right? Okay, the Buddha's was 45 years. So it's a lot more text, you know? Yeah? Into Chinese, translated, earliest texts we have, arguably, turn of the current era. And these are canonical and sacred for the believing communities of Buddhists. I'm talking synchronically now, but you can, you know, add historical nuances in China, in Korea, and Japan. In each of these countries, now I'll do the third one. The third is, and this is again the whole shmear, the whole collection. In the last canonical collection is in classical Tibetan, which is a language which is perhaps related to Chinese, who knows, part of the Sino-Tibetan language family. So it's related to Chinese, but it's its own language. And this began to be collected, translated from Chinese, translated from Sanskrit, other Central Asian languages, there's evidence of Sogdian, etc. Central Asia influence here is very interesting. Very late. I said Chinese is turn of the current era. The earliest translations of material from the Dunhuang Caves is approximately mid-7th century current era, so it's very late. Okay, these consist of not only the words of the Buddha, but in the case of the Tibetan tradition, which I know best, also you might say patristics, the church fathers and mothers, those who made by the community orthopraxic normative spiritual exegetical commentary on these traditions. To give you an idea of the scope of what we're talking about, the words of the Buddha, the Tripitaka, in the Tibetan tradition consists of 108 volumes. The rosary, the mala that Tibetans use has 108 beads. You know, you don't have to be a Kabbalist to note a kind of connection there. A volume, what do I mean by a volume? There's 108 volumes. To translate into English one of those volumes of the 108, which are simply the words of the Buddha, yeah, no commentary, just what is said to be the words of the Buddha, maybe 1,500 pages. Okay? times 108. You may ask, okay, how about the commentaries, the Midrashim? Huh? 250 volumes, okay? Less than 5% of this canonical corpus has been studied by scholars. So we find ourselves in Buddhist studies not unlike what my professor Gunther said is the Renaissance period of time in its discovering classical Greece. With each new text that they found or fragment, the entire picture of what they called Greece changed. Okay? All right. Prefatory remarks. Okay. So all of this is said to be the true or the real teaching. Now we get the emic categories. Sadharma. You see that under C. Sad for Satya Dharma. The real teaching. Huh? So what do they say is the essence of this teaching is Dharma? Huh? They say it's two things. This again is according to exegetical traditions later. And this is important for sanctity, saintliness as we're going. It's said that the essence of all of this stuff, 108, 250, the living impulse is reality itself. Dharmata, realness, reality. There is a, you might call it an Indocentric paradigm that happiness, kindness, if we might say saintliness, caritas, good feeling toward nature and human beings, flows from living creatures who are in alignment or linked to what is real just as it is. Reality itself. And ignorance, not being wise about how things actually are. And in the modern era, what do they mean? So all the living traditions of Buddhism I'm aware of say, you know, like you've got science, you know, nobody argues about electrons, you know, they only argue about, you know, what the meaning of a text is, yeah? But electrons, nobody's saying, you know, Rebbe so-and-so or Buddhist scholar so-and-so said an electron is actually, no, yeah. So there's a sense of a kind of, in the modern period, a kind of scientific way, the laws, which are invariant, not a matter of opinion. Transcultural, it becomes a norm. This notion or this belief actually becomes a bridge for interfaith dialogue. If you could just say that there could be reality that everybody could agree on and then different ways to ramp up into it. But that project, we don't know. Okay? So it said that the Dharma, everything the Buddha talked about, is how the way things actually are for living beings and beyond. Okay? But the other thing that said is how do we link to that? How do we know what reality is? This brings us to D2. It said in a very early text, the Abhidharma Kosha, which means the ocean of talk about the higher, deeper insights, approximately 400 current era. It said that the Dharma comes to us as mere mortals in two ways. It comes to us as text, Dharma as agama, which points the way. You see D2 there? So this answers the question, how do we link with the real? That's nice to say the real, but how do we link with it? Well, there are texts. There is embodiment of what was said to be the inspiration of the Buddha, and he talked, and we keep in a tradition down to the present and on for generations. So text, and text has been broadly construed as not simply that which was spoken or written, but also it can be an image, it can be enshrined. Now some people have said the primary medium about talking about reality is perhaps film, art, dance, music, poetry. Tammy isn't here, but she would like to hear that. Tama, yeah? And it said that points the way. It isn't the embodiment of it, but it points the way. So that's the one aspect of how human beings relate. And the second aspect is Dharma as adigama, that is the realization or the awakening or the wisdom embodiment which occurs in an individual. Now, you don't have to be a genius to think that, this last category might have something to do with what we would call saints. Uh-huh. The actual embodiment or realization of what the Buddha was talking about as reality. Now, the ethics of this I deal with on the second board. You might say, you know, I linked to reality and it was, you know, it wasn't that great. Yeah? In these traditions, it said it's the highest good. So the highest good is that which flows from reality. Reality intrinsically aligns people with tolerance, openness, compassion, etc. All of ethics in the Buddhist tradition, contrary to at least a certain read in the Abrahamic traditions, is not nomothetic, that there's a nomos, a law handed down, a kind of covenant, but rather a way in which beings in their own nature, if they just, as I like to put it, relax a little bit, can tune in to the way in which things have always been. They don't need a shul or somebody else to like tell them what's up, okay? All right, minor difference. In fact, to give it in a phrase, and then we'll maybe come back to this when we talk about the moral torque or efficacy of saints as exemplars, is if you say, if it's a correct interpretation, that the pericope or the little fragment that gets recited for ethics is thou shalt not, the Buddhist version, sikam padam samadhiyami, sikam, training. You're just training, yeah? You're fallible, huh? Padam, in stages, not all at once, okay? And also stages according to your stature in life. So the training for a cloistered celibate monk or nun is not going to be the same as the training as a householder, okay? Variation, sikam padam. Samadhiyami means I voluntarily undergo. No coercion, no threat. Aside from that, so a slight difference at least to the ear between thou shalt not and I voluntarily undergo training in abstention from. Okay? Just a minor, yeah? You could have a nice talk there. Okay? Now, okay. So, I drew a line. Okay, so we link up. We have a realization. What do we call this realization? It's called Buddha. So then it moves the discussion, you know? Inquiring minds want to know. So what's Buddha? So if I get to Buddha-ness, then not only will saintliness exude from me effortlessly because I'm linked to the real, but also this is a way to be calm and to be kind. All conflict will fall away, etc. Okay? That's in a nutshell, very quick. So, yeah, but it's not so easy. As soon as you ask what's Buddha, then, you know, you have to double-click on that file folder to see what's inside there. So, the earliest accounts of what Buddha meant, and by the way, note we're not talking historical personage here. Okay, fixity on historical personage as the sole locus or the sine qua non for spiritual torque is a minor report in the Buddhist traditions. So the whole vexed issue of to what extent the prophets are paradigmatic for what we want, who knows, okay? What they say is the Buddha as a pattern, and the word literally is body, but it means a coherent energy, kaya, is two, not one, but two. It's number one, it means the pattern of reality as it is, dharma kaya, okay? All right? Dharma, we know already, okay? Kaya means literally body or pattern, coherent pattern, okay? So what they're saying is the Buddha, the awakened state, comes in basically two major impulses. And if we think deeply on this, it becomes an emic paradigm for engaging in cross-cultural talk. There is the intangible, vast as sky, beyond form, vibrational, ubiquitous, never in time nature, which is called Dharmakaya. But if it was only that, and then there's number two, there is that pattern in and as it comes into form, rupakaya. Rupa means form, but it means like tangible. So from the earliest times, there was an understanding that the enlightenment is at continual glorious risk for coming into tangible ways in which human beings could relate to it. So the idea of a deus absconticus or otiosus as sort of ossified or gone or the unmoved mover, you know, they kick things into being and then he took a vacation. Well, he gave human beings free will, but that's something else, you know. Okay. Maybe they could remember a little bit. Yeah, you don't find that in this tradition here, okay? So you have this pattern which is tending to come exuberantly in excess of intangible forms. And in time, they said, these tangible forms, they come to us in two modes, okay? So it says 2A and 2B. All of this is essential for getting a feel for what is a saint embodying. Otherwise, it's just we're making comparative glosses that don't change us much. It said that one of the tangible, or you might say transparent or diaphanous, ways in which this pattern of reality as it is, which is the fullness of kindness, remember, and compassion, it's not an abstract vacuum energy, it's a realm of which there's continuous gemütlich, to use a non-Sanskrit term, fellow feeling that comes, is called the radiant, blissful, or angelic. I say angelic for those, I wish our colleague Aziz was here. There's a realm or the communion of saints. Many people have written comparative work under me on the relationship between the radiant, blissful, and angelic realm, the sambhoga, together a blissful realm of enlightened energy, as angelic. It's like the communion of saints, some comparativists have done from the Buddhist side. These are not human forms. They are beings that can be related to through prayer, going up, or coming down. Sometimes you get a message, okay? And how to separate that out from what, in another context, I called psychic doggerel, you know, is not so easy. But there's an understanding that we are continually open to the message of, what do you want to call it? Huh? The radiant. The other way in which it manifests is in more tangible, I put human in quotes, nirmanakaya. Nirmana means it can be measured. It seems tangible. Okay? So all of these, the dharmakaya, the formless, vast as sky, intending toward form, rupakaya, in two ways, as a transparent or semi-tangible, blissful, angelic realm, sambhogakaya, and a more tangible realm, nirmanakaya. The whole smear is what Buddhists understand by the word Buddha, and now all Buddhists know. The Indo-Tibetan traditions, the Mahayana traditions, the traditions for wit that are embodied in the Chinese and in the Tibetan canons. The Pali canons tend to say those other realms that I just mentioned, besides the Dharmakaya, who knows? They kind of like to think of the Buddha as a historical figure. So with that caveat, we move forward. They do, but they say it was in Nirmanakaya. But that gets into complexities here. Okay, we can come back to that. Okay, variety of saintly beings. We're now on the right side. So these are beings that are ramping up into, embodying, struggling with, as a vocation or whatever, all of the stuff on the left side of the board. Okay, so that's sort of background. Okay, keep in mind, Barry was out of the room, but as I said, for canonical stuff attributed to the Buddha, approximately 108 volumes in three different languages and 250 volumes of commentary, less than 5% of the whole corpus has ever been looked at by scholars. So we're really, you know, 100 years from now, we'll have a different talk. So there is one book by a colleague of mine called Buddhist Saints in India, A Study in Buddhist Values and Orientations by Reginald Ray, who talks about two kinds of saintly beings, arhant, holy ones, and pratyeka buddhas. I use the Sanskrit because it's truth in advertising. I don't want to just construe for you know, ecumenical purposes some English that sounds nice. So you can go look this up or not later. Pratyeka buddha means self-realized. It means they didn't take a teacher. It was very common in India to take a teacher. But there was an understanding that you could tune into reality by yourself. Okay? All right. Now, Reggie Ray, in his book, very thick book, gives all kinds of stories, the lives of saints, you might say, and they're edifying, etc. He talks a little bit about the third category, but not too much, bodhisattva, that is, those who are perfecting or then perfected this bodhi, this awakening state. So what is it they're perfecting? In the lives of these so-called bodhisattvas, and by the way, these are the indigenous, the emic categories, for in the literature uses these terms, and in education, when you go to shul, to use a term, you learn, oh, so-and-so was an arhat, so-and-so was a pratyeka buddha, so-and-so is bodhisattva. our hearts can turn into bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas are considered more perfected in the living traditions of Indo-Tibetan Buddhism. That is to say that arhat is your holy, it's not all or nothing. You're getting there. So what is it that a bodhisattva embodies? And it's really with three that 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are all footnotes. So all of those who follow in the list of the different kinds of saints are understood to be perfecting or perfected awakened ones, okay, as a technical term. In a nutshell, they all are said to embody or to be working with two energies, two. It can all be boiled down. And these teachings, by the way, were not just for people, in shul or in the academic institutions, which were huge in India, and Nalanda had like 10,000 people, slightly bigger than our conference this time, or lay people, okay? The two qualities are shunyata, openness, and karuna, compassion. Openness was defined as an energy which flows when all fixity of belief has been dissolved. Now, it doesn't mean you law, it doesn't mean moral relativism, it doesn't, oh yeah, but what about, belief meaning opinionatedness. Now, if belief is a good guy, we're not dissolving the goodness there. What we're dissolving is a kind of righteousness that closes one's heart. Yeah? Okay, so let's be clear about that, okay? This is an important point. And it said that because reality itself is essentially open, they say, one of the ways to be with reality just as it is to note that our opinions about the way things are, no matter how strongly we hold them, might not always be in 100% accord with reality. Doesn't matter if we cite scripture. It's possible that reality, and the whole doctrine of the unknowable or the inscrutable divine, and there's only a hint, but it's sort of against a literal interpretation of text. So they say Buddha, or I'm sure in your traditions, there are indications that not everything has been revealed. It's not so obvious, okay? So that openness and its energy, the proof that this openness is not simply moral relativism or a kind of modern deconstruction of all views as being absolutely subjective, which means your opinion is no better or worse than anybody else's, and they're more relativism, but they have one test. Now again, I'm not saying this as a scholar of Buddhism about what they've actually practiced on the ground. They knew how to fight and be unkind to each other. Yeah, they're human. But it was held as a value. And it said that this wisdom insight, wisdom is the embodiment of both of these. The proof is compassion. And compassion is defined as practicing to never turn away from suffering in all its forms, in thought, in word, and in deed. This is the moral education for these traditions. So they're very careful to say, you've got great, clever insight, you're very good with your tongue, you can quote the texts, but you're not sensitive to the actual living presence of human beings. And you complain. Things aren't working out the way you want. Who said reality is the way you want? And the teachers and the tradition that I have are very tough about that. So, compassion and openness. That embodiment is the essence, in a nutshell, of the perfecting and perfected. We might say these are the saintly virtues. If you want to call them heroic, that's fine. They actually use a term, hero, vira. It's like we have virile. Yeah, it sounds male, but yeah, it is. But it meant having the. Can you say nachis? I don't know what that means. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, this is you take pleasure in doing strongly good. Huh? You take delight in doing good. Okay. Now. 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. In time, bodhisattvas, certain kinds, there grew up this category of maha, or great siddhas, realized ones. And in time, the hagiography, there were 84 of them. They are attributed to live between 400 and 900 current era, and I have a whole handout on that for you. I have a whole handout also on a bodhisattva, number three, who criticizes his brothers and sisters who think they're already perfectly open and compassionate. So it's like saintly disputation. Huh? They're already on the books as being saints, right? But they're resting on their saintly laurels a little bit. So a very famous collection is a householder, Saint the Bodhisattva, who criticized those who were cloistered and wore a habit, you know, and said, yeah, just on this? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. You listen or you go get another teacher. You either submit to the wisdom of your teacher or you go get another teacher. What do you mean, what does one do? Depends on, and if you like your teacher, you know, you can switch. Oh, how do you dissolve your fixity? Yeah, I'm saving that for lecture three, which is redemption through inwardness, I said, using terms that are not, you know, you don't find the word redemption in the Buddhist traditions, but it's a role of practice. So it's, and thank you, because that then becomes a question. I want to not be so, da-da-da-da. Yeah, that's the realm of practice. So all practice is aimed at dissolving fixity in the schema to release compassion. And by the way, it's not simply be nice to your neighbor, it's compassion for oneself. And then so meditation has as its sole purpose in this context that, okay, vast. So we have these great siddhas. They engage in all kinds of strange things. There are two women and three or four men in the siddha stories that you can read on your own, and they came from all different castes, and they all got their realization in a different kind of way. And these are short narratives. Okay, who knows if they were ever real? It doesn't matter because they inspired the faithful. Okay, as a matter of fact, the term for biography, hagiography, in Sanskrit is vi, moksha, m-o-k-s-h-a. Vimoksha means freedom. It is you, by reading this and being with the spirit and not the letter of it, it said it frees you because you can link with their lives. So there are really moral exemplars this way. So it's the hagiographical material. Another category, vidyadharas, in the works of Trungpa Rinpoche. His followers call him, after his death, the Vidyadhara, the one who embodied and maintained the flow of wisdom energy. Okay? These epithets we were talking about, maybe we should think about epithets of saints. Then, you know, I'm coming back to something on number six here, Nirmanakaya, this tangible human form of what Buddha is. Remember on board number one, to be? Yeah? To be or not to be? This is the question. Here it's coming up as number six, but note how I've then changed the translation, and I'm calling it Living Buddha. This is from a Chinese gloss of what Nirmanakaya means. Literally, it means tangible or measurable pattern of enlightened energy. But this was seen to be, although it could be a non-human form, humans. So Nirmanakaya, Living Buddha. The term that is used, there's another term called tuku, which was a book by Blavatsky that somehow they heard in the theosophy from this, and there was all of these influences. Tuku is simply the Tibetan for Nirmanakaya. So there are living Buddhas, that is to say, and I have a number of pictures to show you. Huh? So you can say, that's nice, what do they look like? Okay. Who is regarded as a living Buddha? The Dalai Lama is regarded as a living Buddha, in case you wanted to know. He says he's a simple monk. That's what he said, cross-cultural stuff, but he's a tuku, huh? He's also referred to, we're speaking of epithets, as, as Yijinobu, the wish-fulfilling gem. It's almost like to see him, to be in his presence, is already your hajj. Already you've made pilgrimage. Because he is a source, not the or only, but he is a source of the living presence of the Buddha, the Lord Buddha, the Lord, the Buddha, and whatever you wish for. You know how you can make a prayer at the wall? You can make a prayer at No guarantee, right? We were talking about the other day. But it said wish-fulfilling gem means if you wish with a true moral heart for righteousness, it will be rewarded. So this is a reason for linking with such beings. So again, it begins to answer the question, saints who care. Let me, can you hold it? Okay. Number seven, treasure finders. Oh, I should say in all the traditions of India and China, you find all of these six examples that I gave. Number seven is only found in Tibet. Number seven, treasure finder, Tertön. I use this strange transliteration. It's Tertön, but there's a G letter that's silent. It means, ter means treasure, a treasure, something of ultimate worth, and ton is one who finds it. And what this means is there are special individuals. Usually there are living Buddhas, but not all living Buddhas are Tertöns. So there's specialists even amongst living Buddhas, huh? In which they can so align their energies, I'm using some kind of secular term here, that they can directly plug into the Dharmakaya. They can plug into reality as itself, and from them comes a new text, which is then written down. So here's something interesting. It's not a closed canon. It's an open canon. It is a tradition of continuing revelation, and they're very careful. They have a whole literature on what's a false from an authentic and fakers, and they have a whole hermeneutics of how one can be a vehicle for text for which there was no authorial intention, because it is not of oneself. Good luck, says Barry, and so do the regular scholars, right? Right. So you can see how it's a very fun area to investigate. I did my doctoral work on one such treasure finder of the 18th century, and how he thought he was ordinary, and then he started getting these messages, and he thought, oh, maybe I'm crazy, and he wasn't sure, and then he had these various intrapsychic means of validating. It's like how do you know if it's in other traditions, how do you know if a message is really, well, I used to say, you say in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, and if it still sticks around, it might be authentic, a folk tradition. But the point is that there's a whole mechanism for plugging in to having revelation, and we have texts that I can show you on this. The very last one, yeah. They never said it was limited. Oh, I said you only find it in the Tibetan. What I meant is as a category in their literature, but in fact, as you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama and one of my teachers, the Chogyal Namkhai Nogrumche, thank you, have come here, and they have said, my teacher said to me, and he himself is regarded as a Tertön, okay? And this happened, our friend Menachem, what's his last name? You know, who studied with Moshe Adel. And he said, I know him. Menachem Kalas, maybe some of you know him. He has taken teachings from my teacher, and he sees a similarity, particularly imagery of light, etc. My teacher said, after he came here, he said, there are many termas here to be found. Termas, that is to say treasures to be found here. So this is interesting. So this is holy for this saintly living Buddha person here. Yeah? So when he was here, he felt, footnote. Then my favorite category, number eight, the hidden, the ordinary ones, those that drive you nuts, the shlemils, the people that drive you crazy. In this tradition, it says, never judge another human being. You never know. One of the ways of the work of the Buddha is that irritation will show you the contours of your limitation. And this has been enshrined in a great work by an 8th century savant, Shantideva, he who embodies the godliness of patience and calm, that in the training of a bodhisattva, Bodhisattvacharya Avatara, he said that he gives two tests to show you how severe it is. And the fun thing about this is there's hundreds of thousands of people on the planet who are doing their best some days to actually embody this, yeah? And that is two things. One is, if you were truly content, what would be a measure of not judging and just being open? He said, this was 8th century current era in India, there should come a time in your life where there could be on one side of you a man with a threatening gesture and a sword, very sharp. And on the other side of you, there could be the lovely fragrance of saffron or sandalwood. And there would not arise antipathy toward the former, nor craving for the latter. Yeah? Yeah, right, right. That's one test. The other test, he says, is he said that patience as a way of dealing with provocation, that you don't have to immediately jump to a conclusion about anything in thought or word or deed, is a perfection, the perfection of patience, chanti. And what he says is this at the end. He says, so you try. I mean, this was the really hard, this was like sort of to become a member of the SWAT team of radiant bountifulness, you know. You know, not for the meek, not for the meek. And it says at the end, the one who drove you crazy, they use provocation, use enemy as a holy category, the one who provokes you to the higher truth of reality as it is, not someone who should be eliminated from the planet, as a technical religious term. And they say that enemy, the one that drove you nuts, the one that was nudging you, was just getting in your hair, when you finally find that you can deal with an open heart for all of this, and you've perfected this perfection, this saintliness of patience, your first act should be in gratitude to say a prayer for the one who provoked you the most. So these are my prefatory remarks. We have a little sense about the reach and range of what's called the Buddhist literature, the reach and range of what is reality that the Buddha was talking about. And there's also the different representations. I'm very happy and resonating and sensitive to some of the things that, not without a certain amount of interest amongst you, Barry brought up. And the ways of representing saints, and I just said the styles. So in a way, we have this book, Buddhist Saints. Its style is textual and historical, but he's a closet, at least when he wrote this, Buddhist practitioner. He does have a faith orientation to this. He's just written two very big popular books. He teaches at Naropa Institute, founded by my teacher and someone you're reading, Trungpa Rinpoche. Primarily, and some Sanskrit, all right? And he says, not in this book will I deal with the Mahasiddhas and all these other characters. So that's one kind of approach here. There is another handout, which you'll get on one Mahasiddha, Naropa. Its style is hagiographic, as a translation of his supposed life, by my major professor, Gunther. There is also another style, flaringly hagiographic, in which there's also modern representations of what these guys and gals look like. And you can see here, you can see this is a modern artist. It reminds me of the same kind of spirit. Well, it's the whole thing. I mean, somebody will grab it and want to stay with it. You know, I'll leave it up here. You can take a look. Just gorgeous sort of freeze frame moments from their life. And the point here is the variety. There is no normative Mahasiddha. Yeah? How the tiger got its stripes. Well, it depends on the tiger. Yeah? So you have high caste, low caste, men, women. And so there's, you know, as Sati was reminding us, there is the tolerance and worshipful attunement to variety. So you have scholars, you have saints, you have crazy people, and they do have, I must tell you, antinomian tendencies. They don't always simply bow to the norm of the time, but not an antinomian purpose. If they go against something and upset somebody, it's to put a higher or a more powerful form of openness and compassion. This is important. There is also my major informant for my doctoral work, which strangely was done in Harvard Square because he was resident there, Tupu Tundip, has written a book that is hagiographic cum scholarly, because he looked up references and showed conflicts or interpretations a little bit different, called Masters of Meditation and Miracles, that is simply the collection of one
lineage from its origins in the Dharmakaya, timeless, the Dhammapada, down through the radiant, down through the tangible, up to the present, of one tradition of number seven, Teratong, treasure discovered. And it's talk about all those who are living in this tradition. And I've...
From the angelic
country. No. Forget angelic. All angelic came from the sky itself. Angels didn't make themselves, after all, in all traditions, as far as I'm aware, right? It's not a self-generating. No, it's from... I don't want to use the word God, but you come... It's from reality itself, Dharmakaya, all the way... You said down, they say out. It amounts to the same thing. And then we have a little pamphlet that is unashamedly... We have a little pamphlet that is unashamedly hagiographic and pietistic about a living saint, a living Buddha, a treasure finder. And what you will see in this booklet, and I made copies so you don't have to worry, but it's nice to see it in color. By the way, he's a teacher of the Dalai Lama. Huh? Yes, of the Dalai Lama. And it shows hidden treasures revealed. This will stretch your secular humanist training. There is showing here scrolls and things that were said to have been manifest through his intentional resonance with the radiant surround, codenamed Dharmakaya. And so one form of these treasures, which have as their sole purpose breaking prejudice about the way things are and opening up to kindness. Huh? Manifested in tangible form. You can see a list, you can see pictures of this stuff that was said to have been manifest. This is for... Yeah, you can read. We weren't there. It comes, there it is, yeah? Through his being with. It shows here, there's 6,000 monks here all over the place. It shows pictures of he stepped someplace and made a print in the rock. This should not be unfamiliar to us from other traditions. Barry said, if I remember correctly, he said, saint, I'd like to see one. Yeah, I've heard, my tradition, I'm just taking emically, I'm not making an historical claim, it's almost hard to avoid them. Interesting. That is to say, for those, these are living and they're huge. They have thousands and thousands. And they say, the purpose is compassion. Okay? So, it's good. There's a picture of him with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, you can see. And there's these little stories here. Other photos that I have are, it's text insofar as I was present and took a picture. These are all pictures that I took as how. How did I gain access? Was I on some, Fulbright grant pretending to be an objective scholar of historical manifestations of saints? No, I never would have gotten access. We have the term called participant observer. I was regarded as an insider. I have my teachings. I have a special name. I have da-da-da-da-da, stuff that's not appropriate for here. But truth in advertising is how I got access to taking these pictures. And I've labeled them so that you can see them. And I'd like to conclude by simply reading in the order what it says there. And then later, if you're interested, you can take a look. The first is we start with the Buddha. Buddha Shakyamuni, ultimate transformation, his parinirvana, his death. And you see a symbol on either side in reliquaries where they are burning the earthly, tangible sign of his body. And rainbow color means that everything is going back up to Dharmakaya. Huh? All right? That's just as a shot. Then there is the one who is said to be Padmasambhava, the lotus-born one, 8th century saint born in Swat Valley in Pakistan, Udiana, known as the second Buddha or the precious one for Tibetans in Himalayan. He went all over. And you can see how he's represented. He's a culture hero. Was he an actual figure? The inside people say, of course he was. He achieved what is said to be the rainbow body, which is beyond. And like the angelic or the communion of saints, people all over the world, 5 days before the full moon and 5 days before the new moon, pray to link with his energy to make their life better. Then I have pictures of a living Buddha and treasure finder, Dujin Rinpoche. And then I have a picture of, he passed away in about 1987. He was one of my teachers. And then I had the occasion of going to Lhasa recently to meet, now we come to a strange phenomena, his reincarnation. Okay, and you'll see the child here. Okay, he's recognized. So again, continuing revelation, patterns of embodiment continue, not all the time. Then there's another teacher, living Buddha as mystic scholar. So they all had their kind of specialty. And you'll see, here's the shrine of when he died, where it exists in Bhutan. And then you'll see living Buddha, mystic scholar, after death, reincarnated individual, and who it is. Then we have, the other day I passed around a picture, living Buddha as radiant landscape, I call this. You can take a look. Then another style, living Buddha as sky-gazing yogi. These are all, I tried to choose pictures that would show the variety. The same one, living Buddha as inwardly gazing one, and one of my favorites for Tammy tomorrow, she's not here, living Buddha as flute player. Then some pictures that showed the landscape within which these traditions took place. Then there's a picture of a treasure finder as civil engineer, and he is showing with a chain link in his left hand, and he built bridges to help those be able to come to teachings more easily. He's best known for his chain link, civil engineer by day, the embodiment of compassion. His practices of compassion are probably the most commonly recited liturgy for compassion in all of the Himalayan areas. Living Buddha as humble meditation adept, reincarnation of female saint. Her name happens to be Sarasvati. She's on the right here, you can see, living. Finally, in category number 8, incarnation of divine madman in two aspects. He's just a common person that I felt very strong connection with. I hear he's in his wisdom drunk mode, and here he's in his wisdom sober mode. Okay. It's said that he was married to a Nagini, which is a water spirit, and he lived under a bridge. I don't know if he passed away. We don't know where he is. He would crowd into line for the blessings where there'd be hundreds of people in Bhutan, and they always made way for him. Okay. Excuse me? Sai Baba is not in the Buddhist tradition, but Baba, you know, means, yeah. Yeah, and he manifests, he's Hindu, he's not Buddhist. But he's not Buddhist, so I'm only talking Buddhism. So comparatively, I'm not going to argue. I even have some of his vibhuti, manifest from the divine. Yeah, he has. As you like. It's comparative. It's comparative. By the way, I should tell you that in modern era, and I'll just end with this, the Lord Jesus, however else he is thought to be for faith communities all over the world, is regarded by Buddhists, I mean those who are born to it, not ones who convert, you know, and say, oh, bodhisattva. And what do they mean? Oh, he embodied caritas, compassion. And somebody I'm going to show a whole film of, Thich Nhat Hanh, Vietnamese Buddhist, wrote a book, I think we were talking about it, Living Buddha, Living Christ. I end with, finally, a picture here. Simple meditation master. He's not recognized as one of these big high mucky mucks. So I have two pictures, the crazy, the wisdom drunk and the wisdom sober one, no official titles, anything. And then a teacher of mine, Lama Wangdor, and if you take a look, I call it a teaching in four shots. So you go here, 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 and he's looking at you, and maybe it's a teaching, maybe not. Thanks. Can only human beings be saints? Is that your question? Animals. Well, it depends. The one thing that I forgot to mention, so thank you, is it said that this Buddha nature, this Buddha, being Buddha, exists in essence in all living beings. And the word they use for essence is garbha, G-A-R-B-H-A, okay?
It's like all living things have a divine soul. I'm just making a very sloppy comparison, which I'd have to withdraw if this were an actual graduate seminar in something, but I'm making a comparison here. So all living beings. And then they said, well, how about trees? Yeah, some say yes, no. How about rivers? You find in Taoist influences, yeah, rivers, everything. God works in mysterious ways. And finally, they say, as a saying in Tibet, where there is veneration. Actually, this was the beginning of Lawrence Durrell's book, The Black Book, and he wrote it out in Tibetan. Lawrence Durrell, someone heard of? I don't know. Okay. He says, where there is veneration, an openness of heart, even the tooth of a dog. You got to go to India and Nepal to know what a dog is. They're not these very healthy creatures around here. Where there is veneration, even the tooth of a dog can emit radiant light. So, the doctrine and the belief that all living things, and maybe even beyond living, embody, in essence, it hasn't been released yet. It's like a seed. Everything that was talked about as Buddha, then it said that the path is to unleash it, to educate it, to nurture it. This is why, from an ethical point of view, it's a sin to harm any living creature, regardless of religion. Regardless of religion. Okay? All beings are sacred in the eyes of these traditions. Now, that's the talk. The walk is called history. Okay? There's no difference in essence. There's no difference. What's the difference between an animal? They don't say animal saint. Now I'm really thinking, you know? You know, what is the difference? Difference you can find anywhere about anything. If you ask canonically, and what do the traditions say, they don't make such an emphasis. They talk about similarity, a kind of movement. I'm not immediately thinking of, Sati maybe has an example. Well, you have Ganesh. Ajataka stories. Yeah, thank you. Minor detail. In the former lives of the Buddha. Yeah, Buddhas had former lives. So they continue. The pattern of incarnation comes and goes, but the spirit remains the same. There's a story that he took the form of a deer or an antelope. And he did so in order to come into a region where a king was killing deer. And he appeared very beautifully, and the king went to go kill him. It was on his royal preserve. But the radiance of this deer persuaded him not to kill anymore. And it said that that same place, when in this life he was incarnate not as a deer but as a human, this is about 500 BCE, he went, and after his enlightenment, he went to Sarnath. Sarnath, it was the first talk. It was the place where the deer had been. And there are many, many stories of like animals who were, you know, had the spirit. And also, you can go into the body of a being to do things, you know.